My name is Darren Hupke, and this is Pixels and Polygons. Welcome to a new week of the show. It is Friday, so it's new episode day, and I've got a good one here. If you haven't already seen the runtime, this is a longer episode. New guest on the show, Matt Calder. They'll introduce themselves in the episode proper, but we had a great conversation. Even the icebreaker ran long with us chatting. So some extra bonus time for you this week. Hopefully you enjoy listening to our conversation. We did a hot take episode. So this is where I asked my guest what is a hot take opinion they have on gaming, you know, that, you know, might turn some heads and kind of create some dialogue. And so we had a really great conversation there. So enjoy the episode. It was fun to record. If you like what you're hearing, you can support me in all the usual ways. I would appreciate any likes, comments, reviews, thumbs up, referrals, whatever podcast platform you're listening on, whatever they do, that would help me greatly. Getting to the ears of new folks is my goal, and hopefully they can find some things they like with the stuff that I'm doing. So pixelsandpolygons.net for all my books and zines. You can get 32-bit library, the deluxe editions, the paperback editions, and the retro game zine monthly issues. Oh man, I picked the wrong time to record this. A child started a vacuum cleaner and dogs started barking in the backyard. I'm going to roll with it though, because it is my show and I do what I want. Patreon.com/Darren Hupke. You can subscribe there for free. I post every now and then like an original article or writing. It's also where I can just post thoughts that aren't related to maybe retro game zine or 32-bit library, but you can get kind of behind the scenes looks while I'm working on projects as well. If you want to buy digital copies of any of the books or zines, they're also on the Patreon page at the shop. So a lot of options, a lot of websites, a lot of things. They're all in the show notes below. It's the same business I talk about all the time. Otherwise, I think that's all I got. By the time this releases, Game Expo will have come and gone. Hopefully, I'm celebrating and excited about having a successful show and having a table, and I didn't find the bad news that I was unable to secure a table. That's what I'm currently waiting on while I'm recording this. But otherwise, that's it. We will... man, those dogs. We will have another episode next Friday, per usual. And I hope you like it and listen to it and enjoy it. And that's all I got. After the break, catch Matt Calder and welcome a new guest to the show. Y'all have a good one. Bye. All right. Welcome, everyone, to a new episode of Pixels and Polygons. And this is a conversational podcast about video games. This week, we got a new guest. New guest to this show. I was lucky enough to do an episode of their show. That is, by the time this releases, that might be released. I don't know. We'll see how schedules line up at everything. But new guest this week, Matt Calder. Do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little about you and what you got going on, what you do in the world of video games?
Yeah, sure. Hi, everybody. Matt Calder. You can find me all the places I care to be on the internet at Matt Calder. How do I describe? I yell about video games on the internet. I am not a games journalist. I'm not, I guess you would, it would be kind if you called me a video game critic. I've played video games my whole life. I love playing video games. I love sharing video games with people. I stream them 5 days a week over at twitch.tv/Matt Calder. You can see me 5 days a week, 8 a.m. EST mornings. I stream all kinds of different things, indie games, retro games, JRPGs, and all kinds of stuff that my community picks. So, yeah, I wish I had a more professional sounding title for what I do than loud video game opinions.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's what the people want. Okay, that's what the people demand, whether they like it or not. But your podcast though, that's on most podcast platforms that you can find. I mean, those podcasts are kind of a confusing way of release and delivery, but you can find them on your most built-in and average podcast platforms and other ones as well. But that's a newer outlet of yours, right? I mean, how did that idea come about, and kind of what sparked your interest to do that?
I started doing the podcast in, I want to say, August of last year is when I was like first sitting down and recording stuff, maybe closer to September. And it was honestly an idea that I've wanted to do for forever. I've kind of always wanted to have even outside of doing a podcast or doing a show, I've kind of always been curious about the ways, you know, people do things like, oh, you know, how do you're a musician, like how do you decide this, that, and the other? How did you come to, why did you pick this chord progression? Why did you do this? Why did you do that? So that sort of thing. I've just always been, you know, a nosy Nancy. And I was just talking about it one day on Blue Sky. I mentioned it to somebody. I was like, yeah, I've always had this idea that I wanted to do, you know, maybe some sort of interview show or podcast where I talk to people about, you know, what they do in their process and all of this. And they were like, well, you should do it then. And I was like, well, fine, I will. and I did. I was just, one person pushed me very slightly and I was like, okay, fine, I guess I'll do it. And it's been, you know, what's that, 6-7 months now? And it's been a great time. It's been amazing. I've got to interview Darren. I've got to interview a number of TTRPG creatives. I've got to interview. I have a couple interviews scheduled, and people that I'm talking to, and, you know, people that have expressed interest that we're working on scheduling all of that. And it's been an absolute treat.
Yeah, it's fun. The name of the cast is What You Doing, so that also helps. It's a really interesting, you know, format. Like, it isn't just like an interview or like behind the scenes type of thing. It's kind of like picking your brain in, you know, the what and the why, like you said. So it's just an interesting lesson. So if you all have wanted to know a little bit more about the favorite things that you do, this is just another angle to kind of peruse and think about and ponder while you hear people talking about how they do those things. So it's just another angle to continue to enjoy the things that you love, likely. So I give it a recommendation. Check it out. I'm a follower and a subscriber of it. So it's got my endorsement, whatever that's worth.
they're listening to this, so hopefully, you know, a little bit.
The tens of us out there listening to this now, we're all excited to maybe continue to find another new podcast. So right on. All right. Well, Matt, then do you want to get rolling into some maybe this or that questions and get the brain synapses flashing?
Yeah, I try to keep my brain as quiet as possible during the day. So this is a good warm up.
So no real end goal here. I'm just going to ask you a this or that, like a two choices, and just go with your gut and pick one. If you want to elaborate and explain why you maybe had a tough fight deciding between the two, sure, please do. But we'll ask a couple of these.
Sure.
Let's start with console or PC?
PC. Okay. I'm a big PC fanboy, despite hating PC gaming.
Okay, that's an interesting dynamic there. Okay, let's see, Ryu or Ken?
I gotta go Ken.
Okay, guns or knives?
I mean, there's nothing cooler than a cool gun. Like, even nowadays, even being, you know, the ultra leftist gay space communist that I am, there's nothing cooler than a big cool gun.
Okay. DLC or sequel?
That's a good one. I like this one. I think sequel.
Okay.
Sequel's the right answer.
Okay. Let's do one last one. Say graphics or frame rate for you performance nerds.
Frame rate, performance over everything.
Okay. Cool. I mean, there is no right or wrong answer. I guess. I guess in that case, I am the frame rate. I'd rather have it look fluid and smooth, regardless of the rest of the things. But yeah, these are designed just to get a peek inside the brain, get the juices flowing there. So yes, let's move on into the icebreaker then. And I'd like to ask you. So all the guests get to know the main episode question in advance, so you have time to process and think and know where you want to go. But this you don't know in advance. This is just going to be an on the spot. You know what's going to come to mind here. But what is a game that you wrongly judged by its cover? Maybe pass it up or discarded it or you skipped it because of something about it. And did you ever come back around to enjoying it? But yeah, what game did you wrongly judge by its cover or title?
Oh, this is a great question, and it makes me wish I remembered more of the games that I played overall. Let me look back through the last few games that I've played.
I'll share one then, just to, while you're thinking and everything.
Yeah,
one that I in the early PS2 era. There was a game that came out, and I'm just looking for different things and interesting things, and just saw the cover of this animated kind of interesting cutesy kind of platformer looking thing, but it was called The Adventures of Cookies and Cream. And I was like, this is probably for kids and probably kind of cheesy. This probably ain't worth it. But super wrong. Like, it was a super rad game that used the two analog sticks as separate characters that you controlled. So it had this really rad mechanic and gimmick to it all. And it's just one of those ones I think for sure that I wrongly judged by both the combination of its title and cover, only to have a really rad game underneath the surface.
Oh, I wish I had a better answer. This is such a good question though, of just like, I'm just like, what's a game? Because there's so many examples of that, right? If for whatever reason, the cover doesn't grab you or something just seems off. And I mean, I think it's not exactly what you asked, but I think the best answer that I could give is I recently went back and played for the first time Final Fantasy 13, which is a game that I recall at the time being very divisive, having a lot of sort of negative opinions of it overall, and something that I was expecting to enjoy a lot less than I did. Something that I was expecting to be a lot more obtuse, a lot more impenetrable. Just from what I recall the response to it being at the time. Like I said, I played it very recently and I enjoyed it quite a bit. There were some things that I had issue with. There were some things that I struggled with. But in the way that I like to say, it's a 20-year-old game. It's a little weird to try to criticize it now. It's been this way the whole time. I'm just now coming to it. But I think it's very tricky because so many of for me, so much of my more recent exposure to video games, so much of my the time that I can remember playing video games, none of it has ever really related to me walking into a store and picking up a game. So little of it, even when I was in college and I would go to GameStop a lot, so infrequently did that lead to me picking a game up off the shelf and buying it. You know what I mean? It was always just I managed to find something random, at a flea market or something like that,
Gotcha.
Or I got, something from a friend or something.
Yeah. I mean, the game purchasing experience has been just so like that has changed so radically over generations of gaming and everything. And I was just thinking about that. I was trying to force myself to write my thoughts out and, you know, put in a little original little article or so. But all of the dialogue around Monster Hunter Wilds recently about, you know, how it's, you know, sold wildly well and, you know, everybody loves it and everything. And one of the producers had like said something about how like the investment in like having more story content, you know, is what he thinks helped sell the game. And I was like, you know, in my head, I'm like, wait a minute. No, like that is literally the one thing I have that I'm like, ah, that bores me just a little bit. I think you guys went too much into that, you know, like, and then, but what was the reason I bought Monster Hunter Wilds? Like I bought that off of the basis of how much I enjoyed Monster Hunter Worlds. Like it wasn't reading a review. It wasn't like pre-game or pre-release footage of it. It wasn't like any other like coverage or anything about it. It was, man, I had such a rad time with Monster Hunter Worlds. I saw this trailer. This looks like it's going to be more of that. Okay. Like that's what's driving me to make this next purchase decision is the game that I played before it that was most similar to it that I'm going to trust and value that. Whereas when I was a kid, I would be looking at video game like magazines for reviews, almost like trying to have somebody else's opinion help me dictate what I should pick up next and play and everything. And I was fine with it. I mean, I think there's an entire industry devoted to like, you know, doing that for a reason, you know, and it was advertising and promotion and things. And like, yeah, the reasons that we have to buy games, like, yeah, I mean, you could go into a game shop at certain points and look and try and discover and find something new. But like you said, in your case, like that didn't always even work out that way. Like, sure, you'd go into the store, but like you're getting a game through completely different channels and means and just like reasons to ultimately have something that you're going home to play with. And then now with indie games and digital distribution and all these types of things, I mean, we have instant gratification for all size and scales and scopes of games and, you know, how they're given to us. It's just so crazy and weird how that's just changed in 20, 30 years, you know, over time and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it doesn't even feel like that long, but you realize that the entire economics of it, like the entire system around it, has just flipped completely.
Yeah.
It's weird. And I don't want to say bad. There are negatives to it. You know, there are definitely problems. There are definitely ways in which it is worse overall, but I don't think it's, you know, big B bad. It's just different.
Yeah. Yeah. There isn't anything, you know, inherently wrong, but yeah, it's just the way the kind of things are. We kind of get used to it and it'll change again, probably. And we'll just keep rolling with it. Yeah. All right. Well, okay. I think that's a cool answer. I think Final Fantasy 13 does make sense. I was one of those folks who initially dismissed it as well. And, I probably need to give it its due to actually play it myself. I was just wanting a Final Fantasy that gave me a massive world to explore. And, you know, as we hit 10 in every subsequent one from there, it was like the worlds were feeling like they were getting smaller and smaller. And when I played the first few hours and I was like, I judged it as like, wow, this is just me walking down like endless hallways of like really beautiful backdrops, but like I want like some freedom here and I feel like stuck with that freedom. But it was purposefully designed. I mean, so the game is balanced and tuned in that way. It's just my expectations, I think, unfairly made it not something I wanted it to be. But if I can come to meet it where it is at, I'm sure I can find a rad game there. I've heard so many people who have like taken fresh takes at it and have enjoyed their experience with it. Not saying it's perfect or flawless or anything, but like have been able to at least meet it where it is and get entertainment out of it, which is exactly what you want out of a video game. So yeah. I got to do that at some point.
That's kind of my thought process as I'm going back and playing an older game, of just like trying to not immediately armchair critique it of like, oh, you know what would have made this better, you know what they should have done here, but see what it is that, see how they made it, see what, how it is that it exists, what is it trying to do, how well does it actually work with what it's trying to do, and not try to immediately solve all the problems. And it can be tricky, you know, I you know, you, the sort of knee-jerk reaction is, especially in the age of social media where everyone has to have a take on everything all the time, can be tricky to you know, avoid or sidestep or recognize. So it's interesting sometimes to like want to have an opinion on something 5 minutes in and be like, wait, let's give it a minute, let's let this unfold, let's let this see. And Final Fantasy 13 was a really interesting challenge of that. I think it's a game where they tried to do a lot of things, and in some of them, I think ultimately they succeeded, and you can see that in the games that they've put out since. And in some of them, I think maybe it didn't work, and they, you know, the games are what they are, and I think you know they're catering to specific specific players with the more recent games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is just a lesson, you know, we have to learn, you know, we get what we get and we don't get upset. It's that simple.
Yeah, I definitely think it's like, oh yeah, the game is not like, oh, I like a four party, you know, turn-based, job-based, you know, ATB bar system. It's like, okay, this game doesn't have those things. And so it's probably not for you. And that's fine. And you don't have to play it and be mad that it's not the thing that you wanted. You mm-hmm. can just say it's not the thing that I wanted and move on. And that's great. And I think that's a friend of mine said recently, like he was talking, it wasn't Final Fantasy 13, but he was talking about something. He was like, yeah, he's like, it's not the thing that I wanted. And it's probably fine at the thing that it's trying to do, but it's not that I wanted. And so I'm just not going to engage with it. And I was like, I think this is the most mature stance I've seen anybody take on this. It's just,
you know what? Yeah, I think that's kind of it, you know, like I mean, thinking back now, I think I consume less like content and like previews and dissections of what a game might be coming, you know, like what it might be before it's releasing for us in our hands. Like I spend less time looking at that stuff and more of like, hey, does this, you know, what I'm looking at now or what is available right now that I'm just like, as I'm browsing, does this look interesting? You know, like, hey, let me maybe give this a shot. And I'm mm-hmm. allowing the game to be its own game, whereas I'm not spending weeks and months and hours, you know, like assuming what I want it to be or like trying to project and cast out this idea of what this needs to be in order for me to enjoy it, you know, unfairly. Like, I think as I'm older, I am definitely like, playing games and letting the games just be what they are. And I'm less critical of, I mean, you could still critique a game, but I think I'm less like harmful to like negatively disparage it or like just be like, you know, upset or bothered by it. Like if things miss or aren't quite, you know, what I want, it's like, oh, they just decided to go this route instead. You know, cool. This is their game. This is their thing. Cool. The mission accomplished. They entertained me and, you know, like it just gives me like ideas and it tells me like the flavors that I like. And so like I can kind of continue to shop around and look for other games with those flavors, but I'm not so like beholden to force some idea of a game that I didn't make to be this game that it needs to be like something specific that, you know, I have no reason or right to request that out of something if I'm not the actual maker mm-hmm. of the game. So it's an interesting mm-hmm. dynamic on how we are when we're critical of games these days.
Yeah.
Anywho, we got a long rolling start here. That was a good conversation. We need to have just a conversational podcast without prompts, and then we just talk. And I think that's just a different podcast, though.
yeah.
You picked the topic for this episode. You wanted to lean into this one. This is also one that doesn't get selected that often, so I think I'm kind of excited to hear how we talk about this and how you answer this and what your thoughts are, but we picked the hot take episode. So the question for you, Matt, then is what is an opinion you have that, you know, goes against the popular consensus about a gaming topic? So what is something that, you know, might be alerted on the internets if people read it and thought, you know, that person just might not be agreeing with what I'm saying here. You know, what is that hot take you've got?
So I decided I was going to do hot take, and I thought very strongly for a while that I was going to do I was going to talk about difficulty settings, which is a thing I talk about a lot anyway. But I ultimately decided to talk, and my hot take topic is emulation is good, actually.
Okay, I think that I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. Then I mean, I don't have like a counter opinion to this or anything. I actually lean into kind of enjoying and respecting and appreciating that emulation exists, because, you know, in the scheme of things with like preservation and everything, like we're gonna need some some super engineers to like help us like continue to be able to access and play some of these games that are like dying and disappearing from obscure old media and everything. So yeah. Yeah. Where does this come from for you then? Yeah. What are your, what's your outside vantage point on emulation that, that you feel about personally?
So, when I was, in high school, you know, it's hard to say growing up, but you know, that, you know, when I was in high school, you know, I kind of never had a lot of money for games. It was just never a thing, that, you know, I never had a lot of pocket money. We were poor growing up. You know, I didn't have a job. And so a lot of the ways that I would interact with games would be through, you know, emulation. I remember specifically when I was in high school, I had, this is going to make some people laugh, I had a floppy drive that I would keep in my backpack that had a Nintendo emulator on it and a copy of Super Mario 3. And on my lunch break, I would go to the library and I would put the floppy drive in one of the library computers and I would play Super Nintendo, I would play Super Mario 3 just over my lunch. You know, I'd be like, okay, and I'm gonna, you know, and play Super Mario Brothers 3 for 45 minutes. Yeah, which is a very silly thing. And it feels very outdated, especially now. It's very funny. It's a very funny memory. And just so much of me coming to games, me coming into retro spaces, a thing that has only happened in the last few years, primarily has been because of and through emulation. You know, I had a Dreamcast. I was very lucky enough to get a Dreamcast, again, at a flea market. And I had a couple games, but for, you know, a number of reasons we won't have to get into, you know, I don't have any of my games from that time. And so if I want to play a Dreamcast game, it's either spend a couple $100 on a Dreamcast and on some games and whatever to, you know, somebody on eBay that is, you know, artificially inflating, whatever. Or I can just, you know, head on down to my handy dandy internet. And I can play those games, you know, they're, you know, I don't want to say freely available in, you know, I feel like that's a word choice, but they're readily available. And they're easily available to play in a number of formats, especially older games, you know, Super Nintendo, PlayStation. And my sticking point with a lot of people, like you said, I think emulation's main purpose in a lot of contexts is preservation. Because a lot of these, you know, hey, this is when we talk about the Video Game History Foundation study that 87% of video games are not available in any way, shape, or form. And that's a huge number. And, you know, when you take emulation into account, you know, they're talking specifically about, like, what's the word that I want? Like, you can't purchase those games. You know, you can't go to a storefront and buy those games. Those games aren't available in a format that is readily available and purchasable. Mm-hmm. But with emulation, I mean, I could have every Game Boy Advance game they ever made in just a couple hours, and I could probably load it on my phone. And I think there's so many facets of gaming culture that tie into emulation that people who intentionally misconstrue emulation as part and parcel with piracy do an active disservice to, and like may not realize that without, I was talking to a friend of mine and I was like, I don't think without emulation that Nintendo would be as strong as it is right now, you know, without being able to, and I don't mean emulation just in the sense of, you know, what I did where I loaded up a ROM using an emulator on a computer at school. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that are emulation, quote unquote, that I don't think people realize. If you have a Switch right now and you go on your Switch and you use any of the Nintendo Switch Online apps to like play Super Mario 64 or Super Mario 3, that's emulation. That is by definition emulation. That's the same thing as me loading up an emulator and playing Super Mario Brothers 3. It's the same technology, right? I think a lot of the same groups of people that are focused on providing a strong emulation like community, that are focused on providing, you know, having the people who work at places volunteer, you know, work at places like Redump and any number of these dumping groups that are like, we have to make sure we have a working backup copy of every single PS2 game. They're doing incredible work for the community. You know, this is like the history of games. You know, where would some of these franchises be if emulation didn't exist, if through any number of means people weren't able to play some of these older games that then start to have a little groundswell online and people start to talk about again, and then, oh hey, what if we made, you know, they just announced the Patapon 1 and 2 collection for Switch. Would anybody care about Patapon if you couldn't emulate the PSP? I don't know. Do I say that thing exists solely because of emulation? No, there's probably some market research that they do surveys and see what people are into and whatever. But, you know, with the ways that some of these games are just not available anymore and not accessible anymore, emulation plays a big part of it.
Yeah, you mentioned the Switch Online. I mean, the Wii, I remember, you know, being a Wii owner and, you know, just waiting for like the big releases and waiting for the reasons for like me to like, you know, be excited about playing a Wii title in that moment. It took weeks and months, you know, sometimes in between these big releases. But what I used to love so much was that Wii Shop, you know, the virtual console, like weekly update, you know, like what new games are they going to drop? And you know, that legitimately let me like purchase and pay for and have this growing library of games. So it's not even a piracy conversation, like you're saying. It's just the accessibility of that. And people who are like new to gaming and young in gaming, like with how popular the Wii was, having that virtual console there and having access to being able to play Super Mario Brothers 3, Super Metroid, Link to the Past, like all these classic games, like these games technically have been able to have like wind in their sails for multiple generations and multiple ages. That I think, like, I agree with you. Like that is what has kept Nintendo like still so relevant and exciting of a company to like have such like devout followers of and everything. Like they've been able to like find ways to do it. And I don't think they've even done it flawlessly, you know, like them walking away from the virtual console and having like this, you know, kind of piecemealed to you as we want to, like, you know, Switch Online version is you know, not optimal either, but it's still giving access to some of these things and it's something to build off of. But yeah, I mean, without some of these things too, there's those articles that you can read all about how some of these games have almost been lost. Like when Sony wanted to do their Killzone collection on PS3, they went through and as it turned out, they didn't have the final like data files of Killzone 1 and 2. And a former employee had them in like a shoebox on a flash drive, you know, that it was almost like ruined in a storm and everything. And like, you know, those games, if they weren't being preserved and like they weren't having people trying to have backups and things like that, they weren't having people trying to care about like protecting these histories. Like, you know, what could have happened had they not decided to put that collection out and accidentally like knock on the door of the former employee, who luckily was some form of hoarder of data for all of us to, you know, be able to have that kind of game. Even like that Silent Hill collection, again, it was the PS3 era. I mean, people really just didn't care to save their data, I guess, then. They also had to use, they couldn't find those like final like mastered files or whatever it was. And they used like earlier versions with like some bugs. And, you know, they were like earlier beta builds that they kind of had to repolish up and try and get to that original like release quality. But there was new flaws in trying to play them that same way because they weren't preserved and held on to and everything. Whereas, you know, now having communities like that, having places, you know, where people are being like mindful of like protecting and storing this data, again, not just for piracy reasons, like of course there's there's a group of folks who will do it that way. But I'm also of the mind that if you gave me a chance to buy all these games, like I would have no problem in attempting to, like, you know, give you money for being able to access Patapon and these classic games if I could. But there isn't even a means to do that. So, like, I want to enjoy your content and I want to support you, but you're not even helping me support yourselves, you know, in this case, in a lot of the times. And so how do you continue to have, like, a growing interest, a growing fandom, that sense of discovery to find some of these, like, games and titles that, you know, might be your next favorite thing if they're just not even available to you? It's wild.
Yeah. And that's the crux of the argument that always gets me so frustrated, is people immediately link it to piracy, immediately try to link it to all of these negative things, when it's ultimately the community trying to solve a problem that it's recognized, right? Is, okay, well, these games aren't available in this way. You know, I think a lot about when the PSP was new and the hot, you know, the hot console, Sony introduced something kind of similar to what Nintendo's doing, where they were like, well, we're going to port specific PS1 games to the PSP for you to purchase. And they released a couple of those, and the community went cool, and figured out the technology, like reverse engineered it and created a tool and a format to be able to just inject any PS1 ISO into that wrapper that then you could just play on a PSP. Which was cool. It was amazing to see, because sometimes it wouldn't work properly. Half the time it wouldn't work properly. But it was such a cool initiative of the community to see them taking advantage of a technology and running with it, and trying to provide for the, you know, the community provides for itself. And like you said, Darren, like, how many of these games, how many of these series just wouldn't be as popular or as important as they are without emulation? You know, an example I think of all the time is the Legend of Zelda GameCube disc that is, you know, probably super rare and incredible to have a copy of. But, you know, how much did that buoy the Zelda fandom during the GameCube era when they only had, you know, they only got Wind Waker? Here's two of the, here's the main, you know, Zelda 1 and Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask. Here you go, right here. You know, that's emulation. You know, that's the same sort of technology. I haven't seen a lot of developers talk about it, and it's a thing I think about now when you talk about, like, porting and emulation. You know, you talk about the Killzone games, like them losing a lot of the data. It was a thing that came up when they were putting together the Mass Effect Legendary Edition. They couldn't find some of the DLC for Mass Effect 1. And when they reached out to the contract studio, they didn't have it either. And so, like, some of the Mass Effect 1 DLC just isn't in that Legendary Edition because they weren't able to replicate it. And I haven't heard anybody talk about this. I would love to hear someone talk about this. Like, have those moments changed the ways that these companies store their data, you know, record their games, record their data? You know, are they worried about do companies have systems in place for ports in the future going forward? I had a big conversation with somebody on Blue Sky talking about the Silent Hill 2 remake, with regards to, you know, the availability and accessibility of Silent Hill 2. And I was like, it doesn't make Silent Hill 2 any more accessible. It makes a different game accessible. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes a different game with similarities, but, you know, let's call it what it is. It's a different game, and that existing doesn't make Silent Hill 2 any more available. Is that version of Silent Hill 2 going to face the same thing in 2 to 3 console generations, where, oh yeah, you can't find this game anymore, this game isn't as available? And thankfully, a lot of that has been part of why I said at the top why I prefer PC gaming, even though I hate parts of it, is because a lot of that has been quote unquote solved with PC gaming. It hasn't been solved completely, but a lot of that, you know, if you release a game digitally on the PC nowadays, it kind of ensures that it won't be lost in the same way. It's not impossible. It can absolutely still happen, especially if it gets removed, if it has, you know, certain features, but it's playable, it's accessible in a different way than, you know, PS1 games were, than Super Nintendo games were.
Yeah. It's an interesting topic for sure. I wanted to even kind of touch on like altering some of the original games. I know, like with like doing my 32-bit library books, you know, I've been capturing the screenshots for those games myself, using DuckStation, you know, a great PS1 emulator. But it has so many cool features under the hood of like upscaling, like the resolution, you know, allowing it to like textures to be enhanced, you know, and adjusting frame rates. And like there's games that are, there's ways to like just enhance games to make them look like way prettier, like in more like performance driven versions of themselves than originally available. And getting too far into that and like modding things, you know, could be considered like overriding the original artist's intentions and things like that, which, you know, isn't what I'm necessarily, you know, promoting or whatever, but it is interesting to like, you know, you have this nostalgia for a game. You look back and you have an idea of how you remember it playing, and you can kind of go back and see it. And it's like, oh, wow, this is kind of dated. But then when you kind of mess around with some of those features, it's like almost bringing that like rosy 2020 vision of looking back and modifying it in a way that can find like maybe new joy or new entertainment out of like an old game or an old interest you might have had, like from a thing like that. So having emulators be like so well engineered that they're able to like, you know, natively like inject these things into those original experiences that may help them play a little bit better or add some quality of life, like, you know, elements to them that help them just be a little bit more approachable to fans, you know, even in like the modern times, is it's kind of rad. So yeah, emulation. It's interesting. Interesting topic. I definitely understand. Yeah, this is hot take worthy for sure, because there are folks who definitely are on the other side of things arguing the opposite about like the piracy side of things of it all, and how the original hardware is, you know, the only way to do it. But you know, where do we buy that these days, you know, for a lot of these things? I mean, we're lucky to say like, cool, PlayStation or Super Nintendo. Like, yeah, those are very popular consoles. But if any of us right now were wanting to share our favorite like 32X game or 32X game or a Commodore 64 game or something like that, like where would we even be able to get that hardware? Like at least, you know, in a natural, a normal way of maybe finding it in a store or seeing it on a shelf somewhere.
Yeah, and that speaks to one of my kind of big sticking points for it a lot, is especially, you know, as someone who got into retro gaming, you know, heavily pre or, you know, during and post COVID, you know, looking at, you know, having a physical disc for games is a lot of times just economically untenable. You know, I think it's ridiculous to say that the only correct way to play Silent Hill 2 is by paying $175 for a PS2 disc, and then also, you know, paying whatever it would be for a copy of a PS2, and then the audiovisual hookups, however you want to do that, modding a PS2, having an old TV, whatever. There's a lot of you know, capital A and lowercase a accessibility concerns in that, when it's like, hey, here, you can just play Silent Hill 2. You can just play, you know, whatever. You can just play, you know, Grand Theft Auto 3 as it originally existed, as it originally released. You know, it's just, it's out of the reach of, and I think unreasonable to speak to or to expect from some people. And I even say that, you know, the original hardware is a great way, is, you know, the best way, air quotes, to experience a lot of these games. You know, if you can get the hardware for a Super Nintendo, and you get, you know, one of these flash carts that people made, also emulation, that is the best way to do it. You know, that is the original hardware emulating, quote unquote, itself, you know, using an offshoot of emulation technology, a version of you know, what's come out of emulation, to play these games on, you know, as close to original hardware as you can have in that situation. That's the best way to do it. I'm sure, you know, you've got a proper Super Nintendo controller in your hand. You're sat in front of a Super Nintendo. You've got a CRT. That's great. That is going to be an incredible experience. And that is as close, you know, that is for all intents and purposes, the game that they made. There's still a lot of overhead to that. There's a lot of, you know, it's a lot of ask for, like you said, a way that doesn't put hand the thing that I always come back to, the sort of rock that I build my stance on. It's a way that doesn't put money in the hands of the people who made the game, mm-hmm. you know, and that is for me, a lot of the reasons why the piracy argument falls flat is there's no way for me to give companies money in a lot of cases, money for this game, for the ability to play this game. And so who am I taking this from? You know, who am I stealing from? I would love to give them $10 to play this game, $20 to play this game in some form. It doesn't exist.
Yeah. Yep. It's an interesting topic, but I'm glad you brought it up. I'm glad you came onto the show to do this. So obviously you can find us on the social media platforms we choose. I'm only on Blue Sky actually these days, but at DarrenHupke.bsky.social, but you are also on Blue Sky. You are one of these great folks I've been able to meet in this resurgence of social media for me, you know, being so bummed out by how things were going these last couple of years. To have Blue Sky come around has introduced me to a lot of great, cool retro gaming folks. So thank you for somehow crossing orbits with me. And I'm glad we got to kind of interact, and I got to do your show, and I'm glad you got to be on mine. But we did the thing. This was the episode. So thank you so much, Matt. Any words you want to say before we wrap up, or any other additional plugs at the end you want to touch on before we go?
I mean, you know, come by the stream, check out what you're doing. You know, some people have been very kind and told me how much they enjoyed the show, and that, you know, that means the world. That's the coolest thing. But you know, come check out the stream, check it out on YouTube, whatever. I like to share games with people. I like to have good times around games. It's, you know, like Darren said, I've gotten to meet and follow and interact with a lot of really cool people talking about games and sharing games and making games in a lot of instances. I'm just glad to be a part of it. I'm glad to be around all of it again. You know, I've there's definitely been a lack of positivity in social media for a little bit, and it's cool to be on the other side of that.
Right on. Well, I will put in links in the show notes for the episode. So anybody who wants to catch more of Matt on the stream, on podcast, all that stuff, that'll be links below. If you scroll down or look down or whatever it is you're interfacing with this podcast on, it should be there for you. But that is all I've got then. Thanks again, Matt. I'll be back next week with another guest and another topic. But for now, y'all have a great rest of your day.
Have a good one.
Bye.